Hello and welcome to the Q&A Quiz episode 422. I am your host, Black Friday Deal Seeking Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always.
Unprocessable content, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer, who's currently voting in the Steam Awards, even though Mario Kart World and Donkey Kong Bonanza and Pokemon Legends EA are not on Steam. Like, so what is even the point?
And they don't even have a Kirby's Air Riders.
Terrible.
But I was going to bring up, for the record, that is HTTP error 422, is unprocessable content.
Nice.
You can say what this content is.
I would like to know when that error... I would like to know scenario when that error happens. Curious.
Okay, I'll look that up while we finish our openings. Mozilla tells me that it happened. Mozilla tells me that it happens if the server both understood the content type of the request and the syntax, but knew that the syntax was correct, but was not able to process the instructions anyway.
The fuck?
So that's going to be an extraordinarily rare thing.
Oh god. That sounds like something that would happen in my nightmares. Like reading this bug ticket, like, excuse me, what? How am I supposed to debug this?
This feels like an error you would return intentionally, where it's like, no, that's... Yes. I understand what you're trying to do, but no.
Yes. As designed.
Yeah. Will not fix.
Yes. Undocumented feature.
And I have not played a single VR game this year, so I'm just going to vote for something.
You're waiting
for
the Steam frame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so, it. Okay. That's nominate it. At least one game. Done. Nominate a game in each category. Done. I just picked...
Did they tie achievements or some bullshit to this?
It's community crap to get badges and shit. Yeah.
Community service. Right. Steam community service.
Play a game you've nominated. Okay, I can do that.
I will do no service for the Steam community because it is, like, evenly split between people who will help me figure out why a game is breaking and people who will complain that the game is woke because it does not salute the white race.
Jesus Christ.
Review or update your review for a game you've nominated. Okay.
The internet was a mistake.
Steam Awards nomination committee.
Without the internet, I'd have never met you.
The internet was partially a mistake.
Mostly a mistake.
You had the easiest opportunity to burn the hell out of me by saying the internet was even more of a mistake. And you left it behind.
I don't think the internet was a mistake. I think social media was a mistake.
IRC doesn't count as social media, does it? No? Good.
So I nominated Hades 2 for Game of the Year. Luminous Arise for VR Game of the Year because I didn't play any VR games and I just picked something.
I'm sure it looks really cool in VR.
I'm sure it would, yeah. Labor of Love Award I gave to Songs of Conquest because even though it came out last year, it was in early access for a long time and they've added a whole bunch of new content since the official 1.0 launch, like new factions and modes and stuff. So that's fine. For best game on Steam Deck, I picked Ninja Gaiden Ragebound, even though I only played about 0.4 hours of it. But it ran great on Steam Deck. Yeah.
Yeah, it runs great on Steam Deck. It runs great on Switch, too.
For Better with Friends Award, I picked Little Nightmares 3. Even though I never played it in co-op, it has co-op, so I thought, eh, sure,
you can feel certain that it probably would be better with friends.
It probably would be. Outstanding Visual Style Award I gave to Yuka Replay-Lee.
That game's so good.
Most Innovative Gameplay. I don't think any game is really truly innovative, at least nothing on Steam, but I did Civilization VII because it's very different from all of the other Civilization games that I've played.
I'm impressed that Civ games continue to not play like previous Civ games.
Yeah. And Best Game You Suck At Award, I gave it to Stellar Blade. I played a few hours of that on PS5, and I do like the game. It's just that it's very difficult with the parrying and the dodging and the gliving.
They have an easy mode
out of Matrix.
And so I decided to do Best Soundtrack Award to Doom Dark Ages, and that way I could do Outstanding Story Rich Game Award to South of Midnight, even though South of Midnight had an awesome jazz soundtrack, and Doom Dark Ages had a really cool visual style, and, you know, whatever. I just don't want to nominate the same thing every time. And then Sit Back and Relax Award I gave to Rune Factory Guardians of Azamah, because that's a nice little farming sim with some
combat. That is a
combat.
Good Sit Back and Relax game.
It really
is. We need to save some of our awards for the shenanigans.
We do.
Yeah. So I've already proposed that we do something similar to the Visions of Mana Award and just do the Pokemon Legends EA Award.
For excellence in the field of simulating France.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's going to have some competition then. From Expedition
33. No. Clair of Cure is French, but it is not simulating France
in
the same
true.
Way.
Oh, yes. Clair Obscur, the game I played for about 2 hours and got incredibly frustrated with the combat and the dodging and the parrying.
You can adjust all that, you know.
I know. I don't know.
It can be hard to get into a game when you're having to, like, when you're having to commit to, okay, I need to go through and decide what options will make it fun for me. So
it's true. Yeah, no, I get it. I'm just saying, if you liked, like, the vibe...
It
you
is
should,
a fixable thing.
You should, yeah.
I liked the visual style and the characters, and I wanted to see where the story was going to go. Yeah, definitely. Because,
okay.
That seemed neat. It's just for me, like, what makes or breaks an RPG is actually the combat. Like, I can absolutely tolerate bad story if I enjoy the combat, but the opposite is not true.
Yeah.
You know, you can have the best story in the world, but if I don't have fun playing it, I'm not going to do it.
I mean, I had trouble with the parrying, at which point I just said, well, I'm just going to dodge, which is the thing you can do. But, you know, I need to go back to that at some point, too, because it unfortunately came out right around the time the Switch 2 came out, and then my PS5 returned to gathering dust.
It went into hibernation.
Yes.
Ashes.
Although, random aside, so I, since murdering my Game Pass subscription, I upgraded my PSN subscription to, you know, try out the streaming and stuff, and I discovered that one of the games you can stream is Destiny, which means
can
play Destiny on my Portal without actually turning on the PS5. And I tried it out today, and it worked great.
Fucking horrendous. Jesus.
It worked great.
I'm officially uninterested in entertaining that discussion any further.
Oh, that's all I have.
I
anyway.
Wanted to,
other than saying that the Portal is a nice little device.
I refuse to support the streaming overlords. And also, my internet connection is not consistent, and it seems like it's a nice device for an inconsistent form of service.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I want to... I'm taking a brief sidebar. Right as we were last recording, something of an industry legend passed away. Rebecca Heineman, she had been in the industry since the 80s. She was the co-founder of Interplay, did a lot of technically impressive, like, porting work, masterminded games like The Bard's Tale 3. She passed away in like reason 10 million for fuck cancer. Also notable for being like an early queer icon for the industry. She was transgender. But Rebecca Heineman, like, I felt like we need to talk about her at least a bit, because the chances are, if you're like a huge RPG nerd like we are, you probably came into contact with her work at some point or another.
Mm-hmm. As I discovered, as she worked on all the major Mac play ports that I've played.
Yeah, she did. Like, Wheels was touched by her work on all those Mac ports, notably like the Baldur's Gate games.
Yeah, and Alien versus Predator, and
back when those were good. Back when those were cool.
Yeah. No, but that was a banging port. Those were all really good ports, actually.
Yeah, and Mac fans did not get to assume that at that time.
No.
If you go looking, you can find a lot of her reminiscences on. She made the port of Doom to the 3DO, which is one of the most infamously cursed projects in human history. It was put into production by a guy who thought that you could add new weapons by just putting new graphics in.
Oh no!
It runs horribly, but it's impressive that it runs at all because she had like 3 months to do it.
Oh my god!
Genuinely heroic efforts. But yeah, a lot of extraordinary technical know-how, a lot of history of the industry, and you know, just a lot of good creative work passes with her. So I wanted to mark her passing. There have been a lot of good obits that went over her career more properly. I just sort of glossed over. She co-founded Interplay, which was an enormous company in the 90s.
Yes.
You didn't play anything that she had worked on, you owe Fallout existing as a domino from her actions. So, you know. Just putting that out there. But
it's crazy to think about.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, she was predeceased by her wife Janelle last year. Yes. So it's rough, but there have been some very good obits around from people who knew and worked with her. So I would just say, like, please go look up what someone like Brian Fargo, who was one of the people she'd worked with at Interplay, or Josh Sawyer, someone like that who wrote about her in addition, like, you will find a wealth of stories you were not aware of. But I think that's better than us regurgitating like the information in those, but there's a lot of primary sources about like all of the things that she worked on and contributed to. So I did not want to mark that to go by without marking that passing. I'm going to bring up one other of these like exceptionally strange ports. She was on Lord of the Rings: The Battle for Middle Earth 2 on the Xbox 360, which is a fascinating game because that is a real-time strategy game in the waning days of like major companies caring about those. Played on an Xbox 360 controller where the controller support functions.
How?
Work.
Oh my god. I have played stuff like Warcraft 2 on Saturn and
Starcraft 64.
It was not a good experience. So
it was infamously a genre that they could not crack on controllers. They could never make that genre happen. You would occasionally see RTSs that were made for consoles, and they always had to be fundamentally rethought. Like, Pikmin is kind of that.
Mm.
Or much more obscure things, like Goblin Commander Unleash the Horde on the PlayStation 2. You would get these every so often, and they were just, it was this uncrackable thing, and ultimately what ended up actually happening was that AAA companies decided that they didn't care about making them. But just before that period, there were that last handful of them that started to crack how to make that interface work on consoles. And ultimately it was too little too late. There was no hunger to put most of those on consoles, but that does not mean that we should not be remarked upon that some people actually managed to do it. And she was on the team that managed it.
Impressive.
Yeah. I did not know there was a Tempest 2000 port to Mac.
That sounds crazy.
Have you ever played Tempest 2000?
Was that in the Atari collection?
Yes, I believe it did show up in the Atari 50 collection.
Is that a Jaguar game?
Yes, that is a Jag game.
Okay, yes, I did play that, and I did not really understand what I was playing.
Made by absolute legend Jeff Minter of LlamaSoft. Absolutely incredible visual experience, truly bizarre. Minter, I remember becoming a fan of when he produced extraordinarily strange Xbox 360 successor to that, Space Giraffe.
That's a name.
Minter has basically never made things for things that sold or made sense. Like, I don't even know how to describe, like, the level of, like, danger you're in when Minter is making a game for your platform. Like, the first set of systems he made things for was for things like the ZX81, the VIC-20. Like, those had users, you know, the Spectrum, the Commodore 64, those had users. After that, it's like Jaguar, Nuon, TXK was for the Vita. It is dangerous. It's dangerous times. There is a Tempest 4000. You can get it on actual platforms now. But yeah. And it feels exceptional that one of the only ports of Tempest 2000 contemporaneously was to the Macintosh, and it was made by, and it was ported by Heinemann. But yeah, so did not want to leave that unremarked. Go play Tempest 4000 or Tempest 2000. Honestly, both are pretty cool. But yeah. So yeah, didn't want to leave that unremarked upon. Did we want to, like, okay, I'm putting a 5-minute timer for each of us to talk about what we've been playing.
Okay. One of us has to decide to go first.
I'd like to go last because I'm currently playing something I want to maybe talk about.
Okay.
Okay, but you're only getting 5 minutes regardless.
Okay. I can go first.
Okay.
We'll start with the non-RPG, which is Kirby Air Riders, which is a game I feel like I was not really interested in buying, but somehow got convinced to buy anyway.
Have you put the hamster in a cowboy hat?
Not yet. I don't have the hamster yet.
Can't believe this.
But the game is weird, but I kind of like it a lot.
I mean, it should be weird.
Yeah.
Idiosyncratic.
Like, I got to feel like to put out another racing game other than Mario Kart World, it's got to be something different. And it definitely feels very different, and I feel like
you would not mistake this for Mario Kart World.
No, I don't quite understand what I'm doing yet as far as like racing.
I love to Kirby Air Ride back in the day was fascinating because like the theoretical idea behind one button kind of does everything. Everyone's like, oh, that makes it simple. And it's like, no, that actually makes it very complicated.
Yes, it does. But the thing that keeps throwing me is like, it keeps telling me, oh, you don't have to hold forward to go forward. I'm like, but I'm just trying to turn. What am I doing wrong?
How sharply are you trying to turn?
Pretty sharply.
And I think that's what you start breaking for, buddy.
Yeah, maybe I'm not breaking enough. Maybe I'm breaking too much. I don't know.
Gotta do that breaking and boosting, baby.
But the game feels really freaking fast and looks extremely pretty. Like, it's a really good-looking game. And as far as, like, the menu interface, it's like, oh, yeah, this is definitely people that worked on Smash Brothers. This is like absolutely the same interface, people, because it feels like a Smash Brothers game. But I mean,
all of Sakurai's games look like this.
Yeah, nice. He did the Kid Icarus game, didn't he?
Yep, he did Uprising. But the original Air Rider, the original Air Ride had this interface too.
Okay. Did he do the original?
Yes.
Okay, so this is probably something he's been itching.
The man invented Kirby.
This is probably something he's been itching to do for a long time.
Like, this project was allowed to happen because, like, he's been a loyal company man for, like, 40 years.
Nice. Well, I think it shows, to be honest. Like, it's just, it feels like a well-put-together game. I'm going to have to learn. Like, I haven't done, like, what's it called, the city mode yet. I have not done it yet because...
Oh, city trial is wild.
Because I don't know what it is, and I'm scared to try.
Did you ever try Smash Run in Smash for 3DS?
I think so.
It's basically that.
Okay.
But yeah, you've got 2.5 minutes left, so talk about your RPG too.
Well, I was just going to say, I did do, was it the travel mode or something, where you go wrong, you like drive along a road and it keeps throwing challenges at you.
Yep, that's a very Sakurai thing to do.
And I thought it almost, I don't think it's the only game that does this, but it felt almost like WarioWare-ish. Some of the challenges it threw at you, but it's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And
you've got about 1 minute.
Okay, so as far as RPGs, I've been playing lots of Pokemon, and we'll probably be playing some Pokemon adjacent things, including Dragon Quest Monsters, because there's a backtrack about that next week, so I want to put a bunch of time into that before then. Pokemon ZA is probably my game of the year. Despite playing less of it than Hades, as in terms of pure hours, I love it, and I can't wait for the DLC.
It's coming soon.
Yeah, I can't wait.
You got like 2 weeks.
Need to figure out how to catch Zygarde before that happens.
Oh, you can't catch the dog? No,
you can. Just don't know.
He just doesn't figure it out.
I don't know how to open it up, and I don't really want to look it up right now. I don't know if you have to do like a bunch of the Battle Royale post game or what. But there's like no more main quests, because you get the first time you do the Battle Royale, you get main quests to get Xerneas and Yveltal. But then there was none after that. I was expecting one, you have to do something. I don't know what. Mm-hmm. All right, that's it.
You'll figure it out.
Yep.
Okay, setting myself on a timer. Let's go. I've suddenly found myself... I finished Dragon Quest I HD2D. That is a very interesting remake, very up and down in terms of its balance. I would... say that it like all remakes, you should not think of it as a replacement for the original. It makes all sorts of changes. It's a very interesting additional version with the context of the original existing. Recommend trying both at some point in your life if you care a lot about RPGs. But I finished that. I decided I wanted a bit of a break before I try jumping into Dragon Quest II HD2D, which is allegedly the much more interesting of the two remakes, but I just need a little bit of a break, but not too much of a break. So I've been playing a bit of Yakuza Kiwami 2 on Switch 2. It's pretty solid, runs mostly around 30, depending upon, like, it can dip below that if you're sprinting through the city. If you're not sprinting through the city, it will run at a fairly solid 30. If you are, it can dip. But it's, you know, it's Yakuza Kiwami 2. I love Yakuza Kiwami 2. If you've listened to the most recent backtrack, you know I love Yakuza 2 and Yakuza Kiwami 2. But I decided that I wanted some more Like a Dragon in my life, so I also downloaded Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth onto my Steam Deck, because Fuck if I'm playing an 80-hour RPG on my goddamn PS5. Fuck that. So, got Infinite Wealth running on the Steam Deck. So that's fun. Like, I forgot how much I just like the cast of Yakuza Like a Dragon. It's just a fun game. I'm still very early on. I'm still in Yokohama, in case that clues anyone in. Like, that's the very, very beginning of that game. God, I think this might be the first Like a Dragon game that isn't like a period piece or some other spinoff that just doesn't have Kamurocho in it at all. But we'll see. But yeah, no, it's fun. Ichiban remains extraordinarily charming as a lead. He's just a fun guy. You can see why people would like him. He cuts a very different, he has a very different charisma than Kiryu, who is the most, cool and calm that they could come up with. Whereas like, Ichiban is the weirdest, friendliest dork you've ever seen. So,
hello.
But yeah, so enjoying my start in Infinite Wealth. I'm sure that I will have many things to say about that over the course of the coming podcasts. But that's basically what I've been playing. And there it is. I did that in 3 minutes and 20 seconds. Wheels.
Damn, impressive.
Do you have anything that you wanted to talk about having played Gaijin? I've been trying to keep this. I'm trying to wrangle this section into reasonable lengths by setting us all to 5 minute timers.
Okay, because you know, I don't think I've actually mentioned anything I've been playing for the last month or so.
Yeah, now's the time.
Sure. Anyway, so in honor of my digital copy updating to have English in it, I've been replaying Stray Children.
Oh yeah, I need to get around to that.
I am currently in God's Castle, which is this massively weird clockworky place with some definite Galaxy Express 999 vibes going on at times. Fun. Which also means I am approaching the sixth boss out of seven major ones. So, pretty far into the game. Other than that, I have been slowly working on a cozy little tile called Little Witch in the Woods, which I would be playing now, except this computer that I'm talking to you on right now is the only one I have that will play it properly.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just... It at least this one will actually load on the other computer. It just won't do anything very quickly. Yeah, because it's a cute little game. And other than that, I've been messing around with a Pokemon ROM hack for the last month.
Mm-hmm.
It's surprisingly Pokemon good. Hack. Yeah. It's got several different added subsystems and status effects and a new type matching and a few other things that are making it interesting, at least. So
that's all it needs to be.
Yep. Plus a whole lot of extra secondary effects. So things like bug types can successfully circumvent a lot of defensive abilities. Or dragon types can't have their attack lowered through effects.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or through dragon effects people coming from the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. And I might chat at you guys a bit about that another time. But yeah, that's about it for me right now. Those three. Technically also Ateli Resleriana, but I kind of stalled out on that one in the last level. I'll get back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that was snappy.
Other than that, it's a game of get the daughter to take her Tamiflu.
That's a game no one wins.
Which she is 2 kilograms shy of the point where she could have just gotten pills. So instead we're dealing with a really large little sacket of powdered Tamiflu.
Oh, I'm sure she loves that.
Yeah, not even mixed with ice cream.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Okay, Joe, I'm starting the clock.
All right. I got a stopwatch here, too. Ready? Go. So, main game I've been playing is still Pokemon Legends ZA, because I am still streaming that Tuesday and Thursday nights on RP Gamer. And we were playing it last night, actually. We did some versus battles, and they were actually kind of fun, because I'm starting to learn the rules, finally, and the way those battles play out. And so, when I'm not on stream, that's when I'm kind of focused on side content and catching and training of the Pokemon. I am a rank C, and I just did a couple more of the Rogue Mega Evolutions, and I think I already know who the rank B opponent is, so you should see that come up if you check out those streams. And I did catch a bunch of the Gen 1 Pokemon that I love, and I'm training them. It finally rained in my game, so I was able to catch a Goomy, and then I thought, I better evolve this, because it only evolves when it rains. So I traded something like 700 shards for like 90 small candies, kept feeding it candy, till it evolved twice in the rain. So, very good. And nicknamed it Goober, because I felt like it.
I'm only Goomy when
it is a Goober.
Yeah, total Goober. So there's that. And also, I did do my Bloodstained Ritual of the Night randomizer bonus stream because we got a bunch of donations during Extra Life. So I did that Thursday night. Now, after 3 hours, I had not cleared the seed, but I cleared about half the map, and I have the dimension shift, so I think pretty sure if I can just find the ding Zangetsudo, then I could go into the final area and beat it. But I did get the item that gives you infinite mana, and I did get the Vaskia spell, which drops ice shards, and you can just spam the hell out of that, so that's fine. The reason I wanted to go last is because I literally just loaded up Demon School and played for 13 minutes, so that was something I had my eye on for a long time. It looks like a mix between Persona and Disgaea 3, and so far, you play as a not so silent protagonist who's actually very pushy, very extroverted, and you're on a boat and you're talking to this other girl and she's just like, who are you? Why are you talking to me? And so the main character is very intense. I kind of like her. She's like, there's demons and there's the apocalypse is coming and we have to fight. It's like, yeah, okay. And you get into your first fight and yeah, it's like a grid, but you move people where you want them to go, tell them what to do, and then you have to hit execute to actually watch them do it, and you can rewind up to that point. So that's pretty neat so far. It definitely has a Persona and Disgaea kind of vibe to it, kind of look and feel and music and all that. Played a little bit of Civ 7 because they added a new update with Edward Teach, a.k.a. Blackbeard, and this was supposed to be a big naval update, so I've been trying to do a good scenario with him, with a bunch of islands and archipelagos and have a strong navy, so I did jump into that for a little bit, and then beyond that, just dabbling in some other things, a little bit of Yuka Replay-Lee, a little bit of some classic Sega Genesis games, and also not so classic games that aren't as good as I remember. So that's fine. And 3 minutes and 30 seconds. Don't have much else to talk about, actually.
No problem.
I am going to do the Bloodstained Randomizer again on Tuesday night, and then probably not going to stream on Thursday because of the holiday, and then I should be going back to Pokemon on my streams next week. And at some point, I would like to go back and finish Rune Factory, Guardians of Ozma, because I haven't been streaming that, but I'd like to go back and actually play it in my own time. And still picking at everybody's golf hot shots a little bit, trying to make some progress there, and playing a little bit of Vita, and was thinking about getting more Vita games, and then thought better of it because they're very pricey to get just a loose cartridge. It's appalling, actually.
Well, if you're interested in anything in Japanese, I can do some price checks for you.
No, it's all right. I just, the rational part of my brain stepped in and was like, why don't you put that money towards, like, you know, Switch 2 games and other consoles that you're
looking at anyway?
I don't know. Just anything to anything that could be played on Vita. Mostly, JRPGs, of course. I'm not really into visual novels. I'm not really into Lego games, and everything else is just too expensive.
Honestly, that kind of limits you to a lot of stuff that plays better on other systems.
Yeah, I have noticed that a lot of Vita games have since been ported, so it's like, what is even the point? Just get them on Steam or Switch.
Or just buy them digital.
Yeah, that really ends up being the issue. It's that a lot of, as you'll run into with a lot of things that end up like finding their homes on handhelds, is that you can ultimately get them on something that runs them better. So it ends up being down to form factor. You got to love the form factor.
Yeah.
But I will say one last thing before I say my piece about Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, and say, if you are complaining that they don't make turn-based RPGs or RPGs about adults, well, here's one that's both.
Yep.
Is anyone still making that complaint anymore?
Yes, I see that a lot.
Oh, for the love of God.
It's perennial among people who are not paying attention to what's actually going on.
Yeah, they mostly what they're actually saying is that they want those games. They don't actually want those games unless they are in a franchise they already know.
This is 2 years. 2 years in a row where major contenders for Game of the Year are fucking turn-based RPGs.
Yeah.
About adults.
Yep.
About adults. Like, what are we doing?
What are we doing here? Nothing sane.
Some people just like to complain.
Some people
is this just people that are still like, well, you don't make turn-based Final Fantasies anymore.
Like, yeah. Not for ages, and who cares?
And I mean, like, I don't think anyone making Final Fantasy games wanted it to be turn-based. It was just kind of a limitation at the time.
Yeah. So I think what those people are really saying is, I want turn-based Final Fantasy. I don't care about Dragon Quest, Bravely Default, and 100 other franchises that Square works on.
Many of which do play like turn-based Final Fantasy.
Yeah. But like I said, no, last year, Metaphor Reef Fantasio was contender for Game of the Year. This year, it looks like Clair Obscur is going to sweep the whole thing. So, yeah, I don't know what people are talking about.
I'd have to look back at the year before, but I bet you there was one in there, too.
Well, Disgaea 7, right?
No.
Hey,
come on, Joe.
Guess when Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth came out, buddy.
The year before?
Mm-hmm.
Last year? Was it last year or the year before?
I think it was late 2023, early 2024.
Damn. And you know what? The first exclusive, timed exclusive, Xbox Series X game was? Motherfucking what? Turn-based RPG.
That was its name.
Yakuza Like a Dragon.
Yeah, right. I forgot that was timed exclusive. I actually played that in the Series S right when it came out.
Yeah,
I mean, because the PS5 version took months and months to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, put your money where your mouths are. There are plenty for those with eyes to see. Ugh.
And it looks like we have so many questions in the chat already. Wow.
Yeah, I suspect as much. Let's go take a look. But yeah, I wanted to get through our usual rigmarole so that we can start hitting some Fire Miner questions. Let's be real quick. Kirby Air Riders is better than Mario Kart World because it embraces the chaos. Fight me. I don't feel like fighting. I have a lot of love in my heart for both. But I do respect,
why do we have to make them fight? They're different flavors.
Let's make them race, actually.
Yeah.
But no.
I feel like that's saying chocolate ice cream is better than vanilla ice cream. I don't fucking care. Have them both. Why do you have to only have one? Who cares which one is better?
The Neapolitan exists for a reason.
Yes.
But yeah. Like, I will say there's something to be said for, like, if nothing else, no one can play Kirby Air Riders and think that, like, that everything is going to, that, like, they're just going to get through a race without getting exploded at some point.
Yeah. Well, of course, because you said that about chocolate and ice cream, and then you mentioned Neapolitan, of course, I'm thinking of the Simpsons sketch where Homer opens the freezer and there's a carton of Neapolitan, and he's like, chocolate, and opens it and there's no chocolate. Don't! And then there's another one, chocolate, and the chocolate is also empty. Don't! So apparently he just
throws it and says, Marge, you need to get more ice cream.
Yep. I love it. I love Mario Kart Worlds. I have not played Kirby Air Riders. I don't want to fight you. I'm not going to argue, though. Perhaps at some point I will play Kirby Air Riders and say, this is better in some key ways. We'll see.
Imagine if someone visiting your home was like, hey, friend, I've brought a game we could play. We should play it.
And then imagine if I knock him unconscious and keep the game and say, Kirby Air Riders, what are you talking about? You didn't bring that over.
Oh my god.
I do think it's that Air Riders will be drastically benefited by being on a console people actually buy.
Yes. 10 million units and going strong.
Yeah, it'll probably have outsold the GameCube by its first birthday at this rate. okay. So Fireminer says, the last time I asked about Dragon Ball, it was about some people on the helm that might make unwise decisions financially. It makes sense if you understand that these people care about something other than the profit, such as the franchise's prestige. Well, Toei just canceled Super Sentai and replaced it with another reboot of Space Sheriff Gabon. Putting aside the fact that Sentai hasn't been a moneymaker for a while, there's something to be said about Toei keeps trying to reboot the Metal Hero franchise despite past failures. Yeah, someone believes in that franchise. I don't quite know why. But they sure have tried to make Metal Heroes happen. Unfortunately, my exposure to Metal Heroes is that I believe it was that one or more of the series was the basis for... Okay, yeah. So one of the series was the basis for VR Troopers. And another of the series was the basis for the even worse Big Bad Beetleborgs.
Oh no!
Honestly, I like Beetleborgs better than VR Troopers, but I mean, it was not that neither of them were that good.
They are both horrendous.
I don't know why I randomly got the Beetleborgs theme song stuck in my head the other day.
Because it is the most repetitive song in human history.
Big Bad Beetleborgs.
It's like. They were both awful, but if I actually had to choose between the two of them, I would have gone with Beetleborgs just because it's weirdly
it's more memorable,
hilarious. Yeah. So.
But yeah, I remember as a discerning 7-year-old finding that to be distinctly worse than Power Rangers, and I was right.
Oh, it was. It certainly was. It was just yeah. It had its own weird little charm to it that we still remember what it is.
Yeah, I swore up and down that I only watched Power Rangers so I could make fun of it, but I secretly kind of liked it.
Listen, children love superheroes. But yeah, there's a fair argument to be made that no one's bringing back Metal Heroes without, like, some sort of bizarre obsession.
I mean, that's the only logical reason.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's an entirely replacement level tokusatsu series. We know
that's
no
why it
how
never
much...
really succeeded. Is like it was like
there were so many other things you could be watching.
Yeah, it was a redundancy.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Fireminer goes on. We know that no matter how much an Ultraman or a Godzilla fails, there are always going to be people who are going to move heaven and earth to make a new one. But I've no idea that there are people who are that passionate about B-rank franchises like Gavan or Double Dragon. Double Dragon has to be an obsession of someone with pull at Arc System Works, because every 2 or 3 years they bring back Double Dragon, and like they promise that this time it will be the return of Double Dragon to prominence, and it, like, the game ends up being quite mediocre and bombs, and then no one talks about it again.
Yeah.
It just keeps happening.
As opposed to Saga, where somehow this is actually succeeding.
For Saga, yeah, and Saga, it's not a question. It's just Kawazu is still here, and he loves it. He loves it with all his soul.
I mean, if he weren't so openly outspoken about it, we might still be wondering why is anyone attempting to reboot or bring back the series. But we know who it is. We know why he's doing it, and we know he's actually doing a really good job.
The series is stronger than it's ever been. And then Fireminer clarifies, in all seriousness, the reason why Gavan is chosen is probably similar to why Kamen Rider has been changing as a franchise in the last decade. Seeing less ensemble team shows with the Monster of the Week formula because it's more economical to make the costumes of recurring villains than the ones of the monsters, and it's also harder to market the toys of ensemble teams too, since they require the customers to buy the whole set instead of just one or two figures. Tell that to my parents in 1995.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could almost see that as an argument, except that the Kamen Rider series has been getting more towards ensemble casts for the last 5 iterations or more. It seems like every time I see a new series, it's very much team focused. There's like at least 2 or 3 or 4, 5 in one case, Kamen Rider characters.
Yeah, I do wonder if there might be like an attempt to Goldilocks themselves to like an ideal toyetic Tokusatsu team. Like, maybe 5 or 6 is a little too much to start with, but maybe if we like move it like in that 2 to 3 range, maybe that's they're like science experimenting how many team members should be there for maximum.
I remember there was one Sentai series that had 9.
Yeah, that's excessive. That's absurd.
Yeah.
That's like Dairiger 15, which is a combining robot with 15 smaller robots.
Was that one of the ones that was shown as
that
Voltron
was Vehicle Voltron?
Yeah, I remember that one. I was very confused back then about how it was the same series as the one with the lion statues.
And then it wasn't.
Yeah.
But that one always sticks out to me. It's like, that's too many. That, like, you need fewer. You cannot get away with a big robot that's made of 15 smaller robots.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but yeah, a 9-character Sentai team is absurd.
Especially since it was an incredibly varied group, like an android, mm-hmm. an alien, and a few other things.
Yeah, that sounds like a marketing team could not decide on what this team was.
Yep. So they instead marketed it on the most complex team ever made for this series.
The most team ever.
Yep.
Let's see. Following on from that, Fireminer says, we know the joke that no matter how much an Ultraman or Godzilla succeeds, Tsuburaya and Toho will still be perpetually broke, and the production teams just have to make do. There are a lot of news lately about how Japanese developers, both traditional and gacha variety, are having difficulties raising capital for any new IP. Not enough for them to compete with the increasing production value of Chinese and South Korean games. I mean, a lot of that comes down to if you're increasing, like, I think it's just how cheap is debt right now. And the answer is, I think in most places, not very. But yeah, like that would be my personal guess, would just be debt. Similar to the US, debt is not cheap enough in Japan for the kind of expansion necessary to keep increasing production values indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
So you see those kinds of contractions, but that's just my guess. The big franchises end up seeing money cut from them because people will see them even if they're not as, like, for example, like the infamous, like, first few episodes of Dragon Ball Super that look like absolute unvarnished dog shit. Like, that was probably a bad idea because it hurt the franchise's reputation. But at the same time, Dragon Ball looking like absolute dog shit did not stop people from watching Dragon Ball.
I've been hearing complaints about One Punch Man lately.
Yeah, One Punch Man, like, that's another one. Like, That one I was surprised by, mostly because I recall when Season 2 came out and everyone was like, this looks like shit. So I'm not sure what people were expecting it to look like. But, you know, it's one of those things, like, if it's an established franchise, that a lot of times people will, companies will be willing to shortchange the budget because it doesn't need as much of the help. And there's only so far you can do this before people just say, like, well, fuck it. I don't want to see my favorite franchise look like this. But you do have a certain malleability of, like, the built-in audience will accept certain things. So basically the most we can expect from Japan nowadays is more modern reinterpretations and legacy franchises made with extremely limited budgets. Like Hunter x Hunter, Neo Impact, Nen Impact. I have not kept tabs of Hunter x Hunter enough to know what that is. I assume that's actually a fighting game, if I were to hazard a guess.
It is not.
It's not?
Hunter x Hunter?
No, the game, the name Hunter x Hunter Nen Impact.
Oh yeah, that is a fighting game. Never mind.
Yeah, you fool. I know what Hunter x Hunter is. I knew what a Hunter x Hunter was before you did.
I don't. Still don't know what it is.
It is a shonen manga that has been off and on ongoing for decades from the creator of Yu Yu Hakusho.
I bought a copy or one volume of Hunter x Hunter in French on a school trip to Belgium.
Oh wow.
25 mm-hmm. years ago. I think it was volume 5. So, it's been around for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like it's not helped by the fact that it routinely goes on hiatus due to its author's somewhat checkered health. If you've never seen it, he once devised a absolutely horrifying math problem to determine how much spare time a weekly manga author has.
Oh god.
Let me see if I can pull this up for you. But let me see if I can pull this up, because it's absolutely horrifying. Okay, yeah, here's the... There we go. I think I've talked about this before, so I'll keep it quick. But this was translated officially at some point, I believe, as in, like, one of the Jump volumes. But a simplified equation that calculates a serial manga artist's free time. A parentheses 24 minus A close parentheses minus PH, where A equals days until deadline. A equals average hours spent. So there's days until deadline, average hours spent sleeping per day, pages of manga, and hours spent per page. So what he ended up calculating out was that that for him, like, a page of manga took about 4 hours, depending upon the complexity of the page and how he was feeling at the time. That could go up or down, but average about 4 hours. That he ends up doing this calculation and finding that there are approximately 19 hours of time that he had to spend on anything that was not doing that was not drawing the manga, and does not take into account things like eating, bathing, biological functions, and other necessities.
Oh,
with those, he estimated he had about 3 to 4 spare hours a week.
Oh god.
There's a reason Hunter x Hunter goes on hiatus basically constantly. Let's see. But yeah, just needed to bring that one up. But yeah, something like Nen Impact. I think that's actually a kind of a dangerous one, just because there's not a lot. Like, you're writing two conflicting things. There aren't a lot of Hunter x Hunter games servicing that fandom, but that also means that they're not in the habit of buying them. So if like they, if it has a bad reputation, there's not going to be like an ingrained habit of, well, I want to see what they're doing with this one anyway, because there's a bunch of other ones that I like. There's, yeah, it's just, that's just dangerous. I don't know. Seems bad for the brand. Speaking of Fire Emblem, I previously asked about if a new Dragon Ball fighting game would ever came out. It's only going to be either a new Fighters or a new Budokai Tenkaichi, aka Sparking, like Sparking Zero. Super Dragon Ball Z on PS2 has pretty good mechanics and game feel, but Dragon Ball fans disliked it not just for its dearth of content, but also the fact that it plays like a 2D fighting game on 3D planes instead of being more like Budokai or Budokai Tenkaichi. Those are pretty different, but I get what you're getting at. Do you think Dragon Ball fans have a pretty narrow definition of what they want from a fighting game? I don't think they necessarily do, but I think the things they actually want are not traditional fighting game things. They want, like, these anime fighters, like, they take the form that they do because they make the game resemble the show. Like, they have the behind-the-back camera, they have the arena combat, they have the... like, they have an emphasis on the most characters who can fit in the most references and animations, as opposed to, like, the most balanced interpretation, because that's really what they're for. You know. Like, have to, like, me and Wheels played a bit of Sparking Zero on online together, and, like, the fun, you know, it's fun enough to fight each other, but a lot of the fun was, like, seeing the weird animations that characters have.
Mm.
Like, what silly things are they going to reference? Like, that's in the same way that, like, the Sparking games have the Sparking games are very good at this, like the Budokai games before them, because they're built around, the single player content is built around what ifs. Like, what if this, you play the story slightly differently and something else happens? Fans eat that shit up. Love that shit. Because, like, that's new content for them. That's a new version of everything. Whereas, you know, like, but that also only in part works because you can also just do the, like, there are so many games where you can just do the Dragon Ball story, including Sparking Zero. You can just do the Dragon Ball story as well. But that's kind of the thing. Like, the audience isn't looking for a fighting game. The audience accepts the fighting game because the fighting game is the most logical way to structure a recreation of the feel of the show. If you could find another way, like if you could find another genre that it was more suited to, the audience would happily follow that genre, because a fighting game isn't what the audience came for. A recreation of the show is what the audience came for.
Right.
Which is why, paradoxically, they end up with relatively narrow interpretations. It's not because there is, per se, a love for this gameplay style, so much as this gameplay style most obviously matches the genre that is being recreated.
Well,
but that's also why...
I wish that there was a Bleach game that was just like Dragon Ball FighterZ, you know? That's what I want, but...
Chance to do that would have been when they made the Thousand Year Blood War anime, and I'm not sure if that ever that's going to happen. But
there is a game like that, but it's on Nintendo DS. Sorry.
Oh, you're thinking of Bleach Dark Souls. That suddenly became a very strange game to Google. That was made by Treasure.
Really?
It's actually a very nice fighting game.
Yeah, it is.
Treasure.
But it's DS.
It's a very good DS fighting game.
Absolutely. I just mean for Joe that will probably kill his interest.
Yeah, you killed it.
It's also there are two of those on the DS, Blade of Fate, I think, and Dark Souls, and they are both very good little fighting games. From Treasure, who had previously, their only other fighting game I am aware of is a Yu Yu Hakusho Mega Drive game.
Oh.
Bringing it full circle. But yeah, these end up taking the form of arena fighters because that allows the biggest sandwich of reference and recreation. And then, of course, fighters ends up getting through because it attracts a general fighting game audience, as well as because it allows for the most faithful visual recreation, the most stylistic recreation. And then that becomes a fault when I have to watch another goddamn Bardock super again. Steve, you've already talked about how Kakarot and Fighters got so many updates long after their debut. People have been saying that Sparking Zero has lower depth of content compared to Budokai 3 and Tenkaichi 3, but like those two games are the third iteration of their respective series, both have two games before them, set out the foundation. Do you think that it's impossible to just make a Dragon Ball fighting game in one go because of the sheer number of characters and stories to tell? Like, those first iterations will always get the hardcore fans, like, all upset that their favorite bit was not given much pride of place. I'm sure that there is that there are subcultures complaining that there's not enough Dragon Ball content in Sparking Zero as opposed to Z or Super content. Ultimately, that strikes me as a deranged thing to be complaining about, because that game has like 150 playable characters. But I do think that this is, that there is no practical way to satisfy that kind of person, bearing in mind that like Budokai Tenkaichi 3 basically has the entirety of Tenkaichi 2 just in it. Like Sparking Zero 2 or whatever they end up calling it will likely just be built off of the bones of Sparking Zero. And yeah, that's just how that kind of has to be. But there are practical limits here. I'm reminded of the time that I saw someone like genuinely upset that there was nothing that Mortal Kombat could not make Mortal Kombat Trilogy or Mortal Kombat Armageddon again because all the characters had too many unique movesets. Like it was impossible to make games with the rapidity necessary to produce like big stupid compilation crossover titles like that. Like this person was actually quite upset. It was very strange. But there is the kind of person that just wants the most, the biggest, the largest. And I think that kind of person is probably more represented among like anime fighters, because they just want to have the ability to simulate every little possible what if fight. But because like you get to Tenkaichi 3 and the amount of things that are being included is such that they are running out. They have to get deep into the weeds. I remember like with the Tenkaichi series, they had successor games on the 360 and PS3, Raging Blast, and Raging Blast 2 in particular, like one of its big headliner additions was a character based off of a game primarily for the Bandai Playdia.
Aye, aye, aye.
There's a character called Hachiak, which was originally from a NES/VHS thing called Plan to Eradicate the Saiyans. Like, it was kind of an OVA, but it also positioned itself as a guide to an NES game. And then, like, that entire thing got remade into fucking Plan to Eradicate the Super Saiyans. It's weird. It's fucking weird. But like, when you're getting to the point, like, you know, you get to, you know, what essentially amounts to Budokai Tenkaichi 4 or 5, and it's just like, we have dug deep into the, like, the weirdest crevices of this franchise, and we have included Hachiak. It's like, there, you found a character for no one. A constituency of nothing. Like, I feel like Sparking Zero, its biggest like place that it could pull from would probably be original Dragon Ball. But a lot of these characters would also represent things that were just kind of hard to fight.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that any any future game might end up including them anyway.
Anyway, Dave, allow me to mention pronunciation thing here because it's been slightly picking at me lately. Tenkaichi.
Tenkaichi. I getcha. I don't care too much, but I getcha.
Just that it's two separate words, and I know depending on how it's written out, it looks like the middle part should be kai, but it's actually kai. So it's separate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't promise that I'll remember that next week, but I'll try.
I know, just feel like mentioning it just in case, you know, just in case somebody else is paying attention and is getting annoyed by it. I'm just sitting here like, okay, tenkaichi na, tenkaichi.
I do not pretend to speak Japanese as a first or even second language. let's see. I'm bringing up, like, Dragon Ball Burst Limit could have been a great game for just didn't have enough time. Yeah, that was dimps. I think there was some behind the scenes reshuffling about who was getting contracts from who for that one. But yeah, one of those things that, like, clearly was meant to be the first game in a series, and then the series never materialized. Oh god. For the wheels is in the background.
Oh boy.
Speaking of which, Inazuma 11 Victory Road has a mode that recreates the story of past games, because Inazuma 11 fans expect that every character has to appear in every new game. I guess the level 5 might as well make that a mode, though from what I've read, their entire roster has already reached 5,400 characters, and they plan to carry that number over to the next game.
Why? Why?
I mean, bear also in mind that, like, level 5 has made it clear that they're also, like, letting generative AI do outlines for side quests and Deca Police, so there's probably going to be...
God.
Yeah, there's probably going to be some real, quote-unquote, corner-cutting going on with future level 5 projects.
That's sad.
Until that doesn't work out.
Yeah, I'm looking real quickly. Oh, that actually apparently dovetails with what Fireman was bringing up. There was a story that came out a few months ago which talked about how Level 5 are using AI-generated assets to generate new ideas about Inazuma 11 character designs. Isn't completely replacing humans with AI, but you have just got to ask if the demand to create new characters for each new title in the series has outstripped their in-house artist creative well. You can only have so many quote-unquote new ideas before you're forced to repeat yourself. Yeah, like, that's kind of the problem here, is that, like, if you can't come up with an idea for it, the robot plagiarist machine is not going to come up with one that's suddenly worth creating.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I think that's really the, like, that is creation for not even for creation's sake, but creation for content's sake. And that produces some of the least worthwhile product. Like, the least worth.
Creation's doing a whole lot of extra work there, as a meaning of a word.
Yeah, like, content for content's sake produces like you'll be able to pump out product, but you're not going to inspire anyone's new favorite Inazuma 11 character is going to be something that the computer vomited onto the cartridge.
Hence the continued worse use of the word slop.
Yep, slop, like, the content as pejorative also comes from this idea of, like, you're not making art, you're not creating anything, you're just producing something to be seen, you're making content. It's grim. It's especially perplexing to me in the context of Deca Police, a world that does not yet have, like, that has not yet been introduced to us. There's no reason to start with, like, we've just made here's some slop. Also, that game's already, like, 3 years late. What the hell is going on inside this company?
I don't know, because I just put out Fantasy Life, and that was really good, so I don't know the fuck's going on.
Yeah, level 5 is very confusing. I'm looking forward to... I hope... I'm not sure if I think it would be very funny, very sad, or both, if there's just a complete nonsense riddle in the next Layton, because they got like a robot to come up with it. Robots are very good at coming up with riddles that don't have solutions. Let's see. Speaking of treasures, Genesis Yu Yu Hakusho game, you can see some of that game's DNA in Guardian Heroes. That is true. The way that combat and is laid out with its that was also a fighting game that had more than the traditional one-on-one, and the way that it's laid out does call that to mind. Shame that the Xbox 360 quote-unquote remaster Guardian Heroes and Radiant Silver Guns have really ugly filters put on them. Yeah, I mean, they get away with it because there's not really a lot of other ways to play those, but
nope.
Yeah, they're it's not the worst filter I've ever seen, but it sure ain't doing that art any favors. Oh, that's an interesting one. Data miners have determined that the Tales of Exilia remaster is actually a Unity remake, unlike the Vesperian Graces F remasters, which only used Unity as a translation layer. It only makes sense when you realize that Exilia 2 and possibly Zestiria and Berseria have very similar code base to Exilia, hence Tales Studio laying the foundation for future remasters of Exilia like Berseria. Hey, speaking of, Tales of Berseria is coming out.
Yeah, that's getting a remaster that it probably doesn't
it's
need.
Very funny that it's getting a remaster on multiple consoles that it was already available to play on.
Mm-hmm. Only
like really the only yeah, the only version of that, the only real value add here is the Switch version for portability. Like, I think you could play Berseria on Steam Deck, but for a much wider audience is portability. I'm a little irritated slash perplexed that they didn't that they don't have a Switch 2 version lined up, but
what's the point?
It doesn't
like it was originally a
Switch.
PS.
Like, what do you
it
mean?
It was originally a PS.
Okay.
It was originally a PS3 game. I would suspect that it's been in the pipeline long enough that they just decided that it didn't really need a like Switch 2 specific version. But yeah, I never got around to Berseria. It's been many a year since I played a Tales of game properly, so maybe I'll play it. How much of Horizon's long development time came down to Tales Studio having to refamiliarize themselves with a new tool set? I don't even think it's just that, although I think that took some of it. I think a huge amount of it was that there was, like, a lot of internal shakeups, like, bearing in mind that, like, there had been, like, a series manager for that series from, like, fucking like Vesperia to Zestiria, and then Berseria would have likely been in development, like reasonably deep into development when Zestiria launched. Zestiria is enough of an obvious like, oh, something went wrong during this development that they ended up having to sort of just getting some messages trying to work out with there. But, yeah, like, you know, that was a long run of games, and I think by the end it was probably clear that there were some, that in addition to, like, some key leadership leaving with the now largely disgraced Hideo Baba, that they that like with that there was just a need for a lot of restructuring and rebuilding what that team was, because like it seems like eventually development got kind of dysfunctional there. So between that and determining, well, what does the series mean now? Who is it for? Like, you also have the issue of, like, As we get when we're between Berseria and Arise, Japanese RPGs are at a historical low point in terms of international popularity, but they're only getting more expensive to make. So there's a lot of different pressures being put on it that cause them to, I think, spend a lot of time internal determining determining what to do with themselves. And they produced Arise, which is a solid enough game. Not my favorite Tales, not the worst Tales. I will promise myself I will get back to it someday. We will see what happens. How technologically similar will the next Tales game be to either the Arise or Ixalia remaster? I suspect it's not going to terribly resemble either. Arise is a number of years old. They're going to be redoing the technology, and recreating Ixalia and Unity, that's not the spec they're going to be creating a new Tales of at anyway. I just can't see the possibility that the next Tales won't appear on the Switch 2. Bandai probably is thinking about porting Arise to the Switch 2 right now. I'm sure they're thinking about, they're just eyeing their back catalog with hunger to see what they can put back out. If we're very lucky, we might get, some of the ones that we didn't get in the first place, although I kind of doubt that they're eyeing those with they're eyeing those too much. As good as Destiny Remake or Rebirth are, there's probably not a lot of confidence in them as potential sellers, but I'm sure that someone's looking at stuff like Abyss and being like, you can probably bring this back. This is three-dimensional enough. And, that hasn't been available since the goddamn 3DS.
What about Legendia?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Legendia.
What about you go fuck yourself?
Okay.
That game is extraordinarily bad, and if I ever see it again, it will be too soon.
Yes.
I have such a rotten story about that. I'll save that off off stream. I don't want to say this in public. Bandai's I'd suspect that a Switch 2 port of Arise just randomly popping up is not out of the question.
That would be
cool. You once remarked that Tales games were the fast food of Japanese RPGs. It's true, but there's something to be said about consistently releasing new games at short regular intervals. For one, it keeps the franchise in conversation. That said, how many years do you think it's best for a new JRPG to come out after the previous years? Yakuza can't get away with 2 years, but it's only because Gokotoku Studios is an extremely well-oiled machine, internal technology that they understand very well, heavy reuse of assets, all of those contribute to that. There's other ways to do this.
A new Italia game literally every year. So.
Yeah, that's the other thing. If you're willing to commit, multiple sub studios to something, I'm sure that there are multiple teams within Gust that are making that happen, but yeah. They're all they kind of work on this trilogy cycle, so I'm sure that there's essentially
there's a lot of asset recycling, and we recognize that.
Oh yeah, but not even just that. But what I'm getting at is that when you're making say Ryza. You know that, even if it's not necessarily going to be Ryza 2, although after Ryza comes out, you're making Ryza 2. But, if you're not making Ryza 2, but you're making the next game in that trilogy, you're using a ton of stuff. So that team can afford to be smaller while another team starts incubating the start of the next trilogy. And I think that that's usually what's happening there. But yeah, if you want to, the other way to do this, and Ryuga Gotoku Studios is also doing this, is you need to have essentially multiple sub-studios that are each team is kind of leapfrogging each other. And we see developers that do that well with things like Ryuga Gotoku. We see developers that do that extraordinarily poorly, like whatever the hell is happening to Call of Duty at this point. But that is how you produce.
Square used to do that with Final Fantasy.
They used to do something, but I don't think, like anything with Square, I don't think it was organized enough to describe that as intentional.
I mean, you did have Second Division at the beginning.
They had, so
at least for the first six games, there was some leapfrogging for the first nine games, even.
So. It's weirder than that. A lot of Seven's team ends up on Eight. Nine's originally not a mainline game to begin with, and then it ends up one. And then Eight's team ends up on 10, which makes a lot of sense when you put those two next to each other. With 10, 11, 12, that was clearly the idea they had in mind. Like, they announced them fairly, you know, like, in a way that makes it clear what their intentions were. Like, 9, 10, and 11 were announced at the same time at, like, Square's Millennium event. And then 12 was announced, like, a year or so after 10. It was clear. It was like a year after 10, and it was like, oh, this is due out in 2003. Didn't make it. Didn't come close to making that. Ended up 2 or 3 years late, back when that was that was long enough to have made an entirely different game. But yeah, like, Square was never a well enough oiled machine, but I think that at one point that was indeed probably the intention. But yeah, if you know, to make these things with this level of rapidity, you need multiple teams and you need the willingness to just aggressively reuse technology. And ultimately, what we've run into is that too much of the existing Japanese RPG landscape is built around doing these. Like what's left is, like, here's an entire new huge thing. I think, to the irony of, like, asset reuse didn't used to, like, it became a dirty word among, like, nerds, but it used to be just how you made games. Like, Dragon Quest II just has Dragon Quest I's world map slightly simplified inside it. Because that's what you do.
Yeah. It's fine.
And, like, I think that ultimately bucking the expectations of your most psychotic fans is probably going to have to be the future of a lot of AAA. And just trying to produce things quickly enough that you don't fall out of consciousness. A lot of the reason that a lot of these major old franchises have failed to stick with further generations is just that, you know, you're bringing up, like, you know, he brings up, like, there's not that, it's been, if you don't do this often enough, people just stop caring. If you, you know, if you're gone for a while, people miss you. But if you're gone long enough, people realize they've gotten this far without another one. Absence makes the heart go fonder, or else makes the heart go yonder.
This is why it's so important that Pokemon releases stuff at a steady pace.
Yeah, especially for a children's franchise, you kind of can't afford to be gone that long.
Yeah.
No.
And also, they've come up with a good cycle of, like, putting out things that are related to to the main series, but are not the main series, so they can switch it up a lot more.
And you still keep plenty of Pokemon in the eyes of the children that you're trying to appeal to.
We're talking about, like, asset recycling. Atelier Sophie 2 is it's like the way the narrative of that game is put together. It makes absolute sense that there appears to be a ton of asset recycling. And the game takes us to a logical endpoint, and it does a really good job with this. And it's better than the first Sophie game by a long shot.
But yeah, it makes no bones about the fact that, yeah, this world is a copy of a copy of a copy. And it's reflected in the way you see the same tree stump every other screen. yeah.
You can, so, I mean, you can get away.
That game is a good example of taking this phenomenon and just owning it.
I like that.
Yeah. You can always find ways to do this. Like, I mean, like, Majora's Mask is fully, like, is the quintessential example of, like, something that's just use all the assets you've got to hand, and that is reliant on the fact that the player is noticing that someone, that they're seeing characters again, but they're in, like, a weird, fucked up funhouse mirror.
Yeah. I kind of like that.
Like, yeah, it's built on the uncanniness of seeing the same thing, but in a different context. And you can do that. Like, if you're being smart about it, there's a lot. Like, there are good and bad ways to do it, but, like, if you're being clever about it, you can do some very interesting things. Let's see.
I'll be right back.
On the occasion of Arika's 30th anniversary, I got into a conversation with a few fighting game heads. They talked a lot about, while Arika is the embodiment of the stylistically and mechanically weird fighting games, it's extremely hard for any independent game studio to do that and survive. For those not aware, Arika made, way back in the day, they were known for the Street Fighter EX games, which were quote-unquote 3D fighting games. They were 3D graphics, but mostly played on 2D plane.
And they were fun.
Yeah, and they had all sorts of weird original characters that were not Street Fighter characters that had names like Doctrine Dark and Skullamania and Darun Mista. And eventually those got divorced out of those slowly got themselves divorced out of Street Fighter EX. The company made another game called Fighting Lair. I think they made that for Namco. That might actually not have gotten even a home release, but eventually those were recompiled into their own new weird fighting game, Fighting EX Lair, which has been floating around the edges of the fighting game scene for like half a decade at this point. Very strange little game. But yeah, if I'm saying, games like Skullgirls and Under Night in Birth had to essentially run at a loss for the first few years before they built up a big enough fan base. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that cult followings don't happen overnight.
No.
You're either like a dark horse hit, or for the first year or so, you're kind of a write-off, and then like eventually a cult forms around it. But you really cannot rely on instantly becoming a cult hit. That's not really how that works. Those games came out at a time when Western fans were starved for those kinds of fighting games. Nowadays, it feels like every fighting game niche has been filled. People won't turn their heads solely on the fact that you made a 3v3 game playing like MVC3, aka Hunter x Hunter, Nen Impact. Oh yeah, I've seen footage of that. I was having trouble like placing why that stood out, and then it's like, oh yeah, I've seen footage of that, and it's an extremely like sicko fucked up thing for people who like Marvel, but of course it's hard to get the casual fans to care about a Hunter x Hunter game, and it's hard to get the Marvel fans to care about something that doesn't have Magneto in it. Holy shit, these Twitch ads get worse every moment. But yeah, so it took me a while to place what that was. On that note, had Septerra Core come out during the dark days of the Japanese RPG in the late 2000s, would it have been more fondly remembered? There was a whole generation of indie RPG tried to fill the void during those days. The answer is, I don't think so, because like a lot of the, during that time, a lot of the people who cared about traditional Japanese RPGs ended up playing Japanese RPGs that they had just never played because they hadn't released here or had released in very limited quantities. That's, you know, around the time people really a lot of people get into things like Bahamut Lagoon, Tengai Makyo.
The emulation period.
Yep. Some of the Saga games we hadn't gotten to that point.
Which was most of the Saga games.
Yeah, like just a lot of those. Holy shit, that Black Friday PlayStation ad was fucking nonsense. What the fuck? Why was there a helicopter there? Whatever, doesn't matter. But yeah, like I think that like without some sort of big name advocate to put their stamp on it, something like those indie RPGs just have difficulty finding an audience. Like there's, you know, like there were ways for that to happen, obviously, especially once we got into the 2010s. Like, I mean, Undertale becomes a big deal in part because Toby Fox has like it had gained some level of cult following by dint of having been heavily involved with cult webcomic Homestuck.
That brings me back.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, but without something to hang your hat on, like you're lost in a sea even back then, because like you're not just competing with the new ones, you're competing with the old ones people never played. And that's a rough spot to be in when your competition is live.
I was hoping that when Blaze Blue Cross Tag Battle came out, that would kind of further elevate Under Night Inbirth, and that game itself didn't seem to do very well, and people kind of forgot about it.
Under Night what now?
Under Night Inbirth.
What the hell is that?
Fireminer just mentioned
it. It's a fighting game.
Yeah.
That must have been while I was away. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's an indie game from Soft Circle French Bread.
Yeah.
Which,
I don't
want to
go.
You know,
I don't want to derail things any further, but I have been playing Street Fighter VI while we've been talking, and I finally found Sea Viper. And
nice.
First, she electrocutes you and knocks you out. And
as you'd expect.
Then, well, actually, hang on. First, you have to fight a bunch of malfunctioning Roombas, refrigerators, and drones. Then you have to go into the laboratory, and you get. Someone puts a bag over your head and electrocutes you and tells you to leave. Then you confront Sea Viper, and she almost lets you plummet to your death, but doesn't. And then she creates a very realistic hologram of M. Bison that starts malfunctioning, and the two of you have to team up to fight him. And then she's like, okay, fine, I'll train you. So.
Now that happens. That's awesome. But yeah. So yeah, like Soft Circle French Bread is also one of those companies that was able to sustain itself by dint of having its origins and being a doujin circle and kind of not really having an expectation of high margins.
No.
The
second game, yeah. I played briefly, and it's very similar to the first game, and it's like, it's fine. You know, not my favorite fighting game.
It's your fighting game, Psycho.
Yeah. It's fine.
Okay. Lately, I've been asking a lot about how the live service game model restricts how new characters are designed narratively and mechanically. What I haven't asked about is the character designs themselves. Gotcha games like Snowbreak, Azure Lane, Love in Deep Space, etc. want to make you as horny as possible, but then instead of catering to a wide variety of body types, what I see is a gradual homogenization of character designs. Yeah, no, it's not wrong. Like,
yeah.
These, like, ultimately they want to produce, like, and this is part of why, like, even if I didn't find the gameplay of these things repugnant, like if I didn't find the business behind them like personally repellent, even if I didn't find the gameplay boring, I can't get into these because like I've ranted about this to people completely unrelated to this. But there's a bit in Metal Gear Solid where Otacon is rambling about why he built a flaw into Metal Gear Rex to make sure, when Snake asks if there's a way to destroy it, and he's like, oh yeah, I put in a flaw, And Snake is like, why on earth did you do that? Because that's a reasonable question when you're talking about your walking battle tank. And he's just like, I think of it as a character flaw. Like, people just aren't complete without a character flaw. And ultimately, when I look at gacha game characters, I see something that is made with machined precision to activate neurons. And when I see it, all I can think is how artificial it feels, without some flaw, without something in there to like be proof that there is something here other than the design, than like a calculated attack on the libido of like half of the internet. Without that, without something to distract from that, like a flaw that breaks the illusion, like, the illusion shatters more completely for me, because it's just like, I've seen you. I have seen a million anime girls like you. You look exactly like all of them.
Yep.
And like this is the old idea that like, it's the same way that if you reference the fourth wall, but in a way you can kind of reinforce it more, because referencing the unreality produces a new sense of reality when it's produced. Creating a character that is attractive but with flaws can make them much more interesting and cause a deeper emotional connection.
Sort of support this argument, Uma Musume.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the,
like, one of the most popular girls? Ones is the one that's an absolute fuck up.
Yeah. It's just because, I mean, it's calculated, again, it's very precisely made, but they also made these character personalities a mashup of the horse, the regular jockey, and the public perception of them. So you end up with some glorious disasters of characters.
There is something to be said for just having that element of they're beholden to some outside force that they have to mold the character around, so there is an inherent reality underneath them that gives them a bit more sticking.
I mean, that there was that one, there's the one character who's based on the little racehorse who literally lost.
Yeah, the one that's just an absolute fuck up that lost every race it was ever in.
But it was still a fan favorite because everyone just loved to cheer her on. And then the global period of mourning when that horse died last summer.
Yeah, yeah. Haru Urara.
Yes. That's the kind of connection that most gacha games would kill for, and they can't do it because it's not... like inherently impossible to their design philosophy.
Yeah, if you're building for like what will get the most pulls, you end up producing characters that are, it's harder to make them stick, because the other thing is it's hard to differentiate them, harder to differentiate them amongst themselves. Like, you know, you're 30, 40, 50 characters deep into your gacha game, and like there are flaws they can have, but they're all of a kind that is designed to make sure that the character is still attractive. And you end up producing something that puts severe constraints on what you can do, on the kinds of stories you can tell, on what their relationship with the player protagonist surrogate can be. There's just a lot of things that kind of make it hard. You can say that it's because studios target a specific group of people with specific needs, since they are the ones who pay the most. But can you also say that even in the space, most people are pretty vanilla in their taste? There's definitely some of that as well. Like, but I think it's also just like people. Yes, people are vanilla in their taste, but also you can get people to turn into freaks for a lot of things if you try a little bit. Like. Mm-hmm. An unusual number of people within the past 5 years were ready to talk about their willingness to fuck a fish man. for an Oscar-winning film. Like,
yeah.
You, like, if you're just, like, people are vanilla in their taste when you are trying to get them to open, like, to look at a poster. But, you know, and this does come back to every character has to be treated like an individual sellable good, which produces this, like, unwillingness to produce weird little freaks because people might not immediately latch on to them. But I think that it's also, like, kind of bad for your game long term if you're trying to sell every character to every player, for the same reason that, like, to use another thing, not every card in Magic is for every deck.
Yes. I like this analogy. Like,
and so when you're producing gacha characters, you need to include freaks. You need to include little weirdos. You need to include people, characters that appeal to people with niche tastes, because those people will evangelize the game to people who would not immediately be pulled into it. They will help people find new favorites. They will pull in weirdos, like, in the same way that, like, true, like, sickos to a card game will pull people in by, like, their devotion to, like, producing their mad scientist deck.
Also, people who like Blanca and Dalsum, huh? How about that?
Yep, there will, like, they will always be relatively low on the playlist, but you need them to help round things out because those freaks help. You need, like, if you're just aiming for the mainstream, you will not, you will eventually reach the point where it's like, you know, I'm sure I've said this in other contexts, like, the mainstream is the things everyone can agree are fine. They're not the things everyone loves. They're the things that people don't typically hate. But you need the niche and the outliers, and as a whole, gacha games have scientifically found all of the mainstream. They found it. It's there.
Gacha games are like the marriage between video games and social media, and just those dopamine hits, and you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let's see. Previously asked about why people thought the Evercade was anti-consumer just because they didn't put all the Mel Slugs in a single compilation. That's I'm just looking at the list of questions. That said, will a patch like the Orange Box ever exist again, given each individual game's perceived value and long-term playability? The closest I can think of are the Capcom collections. I mean, you can still find collections of old games. I think that the Orange Box was notable because three of the games were entirely new at the time. In which case, no, you're not going to see that again. You barely saw that then. But compilations exist and will still exist because a lot of older games have some value by themselves, but they need, like, people will go back for, like, a collection that has old Street Fighter games or old, you know, Final Fantasy games or whatever, but they might not. But they might be a little hesitant on buying just those, given that, you know, they are older titles. People don't spend as much on older titles. So you include other old titles that players might not realize they want, or, you know, might have niche followings, because it helps round out the package.
Well, it does seem like every fighting game has at least that one super weird character that I never play, but I get it, like Faust in Guilty Gear and Eddie in Persona 4 Arena.
I mean, that's just Arxis being Arxis. They like their they like their little they like their tricky weirdos.
Yep. Can't stand them.
But yeah, like, I mean, a well-rounded fighting game cast needs those weirdos, like, the same way that, like, they're all, like, you get your zoners, your keepaways, your, like, how the hell does this fucker work? Your grapplers, your general, like, Shotos that kind of do everything. Like, all of those exists to fill certain niches, and it ends up being like the game itself that determines how valuable those niches are to fill.
Yeah. Okay, something I saw a day or two ago somewhere, and it seems kind of appropriate now, but I think it was the company that makes Guilty Gear.
Yeah,
okay. Was trying to figure out how to data on how to better rebalance some things.
Yeah,
and they finally had to announce that they found that player feedback had become completely useless.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
The only thing it was useful for was determining which influencer videos the players were watching at the time.
Yeah, I mean, like. There's like a multitude of reasons that like online chatter is bad. It's an unrepresentative sample. Like
apparently getting worse at being unrepresentative.
Yeah, so. Like, you know, the vast majority of people who play something or watch something or read something, they don't talk that much. They don't talk online to random strangers about it. That's weird behavior. And, you know, like, for most people, that's kind of, they don't need that in their lives. Like, no. And then among the people who do, a lot of them, like, are aware that they don't have, like, a deep understanding of it, so they seek out people who seem like they do. And then those people kind of set the discussion around things.
And not necessarily in any resemblance of reality, but just their own personal beef with something.
Yeah, and I mean, that's true. That's true of everyone. That's true of us. That's true of anyone. But...
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it can get really funny.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. But, yeah, like, you end up with these things where people will have these discussions. And, like, you know, ultimately... the most you can take from this, and this, even this isn't reliable. The most you could take from this is whether the fan base is mad, but that's not reliable either. Cause like, you'll see shit like Ubisoft, like very publicly announcing that, like, you know, despite, you know, a bunch of buzzing nonsense around Yasuke in Assassin's Creed Shadows, that like that there was nothing to it. There was no fire behind any of that smoke. It was just people being mad as a purely like political purpose. And you know, so like listening to people online is bad. It's bad for you. It is bad for your product. It is bad for your art.
Well, we just got that story that when you reveal the locations of these like far-right accounts on X, they're all in Russia, Turkey, Eastern Europe. They're not, like, you know, me, I am super MAGA cowboy, and it's like you're not even in the U.S., and they're just bad actors trying to monetize clickbait on X, you know?
A whole lot of the current Japanese nationalist Twitter is based out of Eastern Europe.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of perverse incentives around, like, stirring up anger in... the kind of person who wants to be angry, and there's a certain kind of person that really likes being angry.
Yep.
And I mean, just the simple economics of getting enough attention and then selling the account because you can prove that it has attention on it.
Yep. There's just a lot of stuff there. Oh, Lord. I'm going to actually say that I think we need to cut this short because I have a work thing that's going to keep me up in like 3 hours. So.
Oh, yeah. Let's wrap it up then.
Mm-hmm. What could I read if I wanted to read myself to sleep?
Oh, speaking of small content creator caught in the sea of everything else going on and... lost and adrift and begging people to pay attention, please, please, please throw me a line. We have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor for Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. Let's see, if you enjoy tabletop role-playing games but do not have the time to do anything but vicariously enjoy other people's role-playing games, tabletop, and which, honestly, I mean, we all know that there is an entire industry of video providers on the internet for this nowadays. Princesses of the Pizza Parlor by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, with 13 episodes, 5 side stories, 1 very long paralogue, and a bit more to come. Promise. Again, Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. And then moving on, we have Tanuki as a Teapot, Japanese Folktales. Reinterpreted, rewritten, and occasionally re-illustrated by yours truly. Again, Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. And then moving on, we have Vainglorious Long Is the Night, a lit RPG that came to be after I had probably played too many Metroidvania clones over the course of a 15-month period. You can just check it out and you'll see why I say that.
It'll be clear.
Yes. Yep. But yes, Vainglorious Long Is the Night, available in print replica edition, which has all of the fun font choices and character stuff that I had just loved to try and play around with. And then the reflowable text edition, which actually works better as an ebook if you like things like portrait mode and dark mode. Take your pick. I mean, that version comes into existence because a certain friend of the show was very sorry about not being able to read it properly because they do require dark mode for accessibility purposes. So there's two versions of it out there. They are the same thing. Just one has more funny font choices and a really cool alphanumeric character, which just does not work well with ebooks. The recurring issues. Let's just leave it at that. It got really annoying. And then finally, for something completely different under a completely or theoretically different pen name, we have A Wager for Wanderlust, which was, it started out as a fantasy world travelogue, which somehow ended up becoming romantasy and a few other things. It's under the name Michael Spearwater, Spearwater, partly because I don't want any of my young adult fantasy readers to be locating this one by accident. So if you are at all interested in seeing what I have, it's right there. Okay. More to come. A lot more to come. Hopefully I've got... I've pretty much given up on actual publishing companies at this point, so... Let's just go indie all the way. I've got like 10 books I could publish next year if I could get covers together. Let's just do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, pray for a cult following eventually, but you never... It's like shooting for the moon. Yeah. Moving on.
Joe, tell us about your streams.
Yeah, so I'm a streamer for RPGamer.com, which is the Twitch channel you might be watching right now. So every Tuesday night around 10 p.m. and every Thursday night around 9 p.m. Eastern Time, I do live streams on the RP Gamer Twitch channel. I've been doing Pokemon. The goal for this week, as I mentioned earlier, was let's try to finish this Bloodstained Ritual of the Night randomizer seed, and then probably no stream Thursday, but then next week I'll go back to Pokemon Legends EA. I want to keep playing that on stream until I beat the main story, at least, and possibly beyond that. We'll see. You can also follow me on Blue Sky if you want, Joey at smokeandjoegamer.bsky.social. I have a YouTube channel with like 400 something videos of various games from all different genres. I just realized it is now November 25th. Black Friday is this Friday, and the deals have already started. So I may want to get started on my annual holiday buying guide series, and that's where I may do you know, between 20 and 60 minutes, you know, either live stream a game or just record myself playing it while I talk about it and just tell you what I liked, didn't like. And I do try to focus more so on games I actually liked and actually finished or put significant time into. So, you know, stay tuned for that. I'm probably just going to be on YouTube. So check that out under Smokin' Joe Gamer. And, yeah, I'm always thinking about new content I can put up, and it's just a matter of, you know, motivating myself to actually do it. So maybe I'll do more music album reviews at some point. Maybe I'll do more guitar playing videos at some point, you know. You never know. Just whatever I feel like. So please consider checking that out. Like, subscribe, follow, whatever.
Ring the bell.
Yeah, it's contextual.
Okay. As for us, thank you once again to Fireminer for providing our questions this week. You can ask us questions by catching us when we stream, which is typically at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, or thereabouts on twitch.tv/rpgamer on Mondays on twitch.tv/rpgamer and twitch.tv/askwheels. Also have our sister show Shenanigans, where we play games and generally bullshit around. That's Sunday night, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern. You can also ask us questions by putting a comment under this very episode. That's fair to say. Or you can ask questions in the RP Gamer Discord, which you can find by going to the, which you can get an invite to by going to the community tab on rpgamer.com. It's a lovely community, whether you want to ask us questions or not. But if you put one, if you put a question for us in the podcast section, we'll always be happy to read it. Otherwise, I think that wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Scout Boys.
See you.
See you. This is Mole Man.
Good Mole Man to you.
Nerd!
That's not what that is at all.
Did somebody mix up the names?
No.